6. Vigilante violence. It is not permissible that the authors of devastation should also be innocent. It is the innocence which constitutes the crime. James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time. My mother's family arrived in Watertown, Massachusetts in 1633 in the figure of John Prince, a Puritan fleeing Britain. My father's family landed with William Hedges, a tanner and also a Puritan refugee, in East Hampton, New York in 1650. As time passed, the huge tributaries of these two families intersected with every major event in American life. My forebears included soldiers, whalers, and sea captains, farmers, a few writers and scholars, and a smattering of political leaders who ascended to governorships. By the time of the Civil War, the family included a Union general and a colonel in the elite Iron Brigade on one side and a Confederate spy on the other. A couple of my ancestors took part in the brutal Indian Wars. One was a scout for General Philip Sheridan on the Western Plains. Lakota warriors murdered him, a fate he appears to have deserved, given the drunken, murderous rampages against Indian encampments he describes in letters home to Maine. Other ancestors were sober, dour-looking Anglican ministers, teachers, and abolitionists. A distant relative of my father's family became the largest landowner in Cuba after 1898, when it was seized by force from the Spanish. A few of this family's descendants worked with the CIA in the fight against Fidel Castro in the waning days of the Batista dictatorship. My maternal grandfather, who worked most of his life in a small town post office, served as a master sergeant in the Maine Army National Guard in the 1930s. He and other guardsmen regularly waded into the crowds of striking textile and mill workers to violently break up labor unrest. He kept his army-issued truncheon in his barn. It had 23 small nicks he had made with his penknife. One nick, he told me, for every communist I hit. My father and most of my uncles fought in World War II. One uncle was severely maimed, physically and psychologically, in the South Pacific, and drank himself to death. I was in Central America in the 1980s during the proxy wars waged by Washington. I accompanied a Marine Corps battalion as it battled Iraqi troops into Kuwait during the first Gulf War. My family history intersects with the persistent patterns of violence that are a constant in American life, both at home and abroad. Any rebellion must contend with this endemic American violence, especially vigilante violence, as well as the sickness of the gun culture that is its natural expression. As it has done throughout American history, the state under siege will turn to extrajudicial groups of armed thugs to repress populist movements. Radical change in America is paid for with blood. There are some 310 million firearms in the United States, including 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. There is no reliable data on the number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, but the working estimate is about 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 89 per 100 people, according to the 2007 Small Arms Survey. By comparison, Canada has 31 per 100 people. Canada usually sees under 200 gun-related homicides a year. Our addiction to violence and bloodletting, which will continue to grow, marks a nation in terminal decline. The view of ourselves as divine agents of purification anointed by God and progress to reconfigure the world around us is a myth that remains firmly embedded in the American psyche. Most of our historians, with only a few exceptions, such as Eric Foner, Howard Zinn, Richard Hofstadter, and Richard Slotkin, studiously avoid addressing these patterns of violence. They examine a single foreign war. They chronicle an isolated incident, such as the draft riots in New York during the Civil War. They write about the Indian Wars. They detail the cruelty of Jim Crow and lynching. They do not see in the totality of our military adventures, including our bloody occupation of the Philippines when General Jacob H. Smith ordered his troops to kill every Filipino over the age of 10 and turn the island of Samar into a howling wilderness, A universal truth about the American soul and the naturalness with which we turn to violence at home and abroad. We suffer from a dangerous historical amnesia and self-delusional fantasies about the virtues and goodness of ourselves and of empire. We have masked our cultural propensity for widespread and indiscriminate murder. The essential American soul is hard, isolate, stoic, and a killer, D.H. Lawrence wrote. It has never yet melted. Violence in America is not restricted to state violence. There is a tradition of vigilante violence that is used, usually with the state's tacit, if unofficial, blessing, to crush dissent, to keep repressed minorities in a state of fear, or to exact revenge on those the state has branded as traitors. It is a product of hatred, not hope. It is directed against the weak, not the strong. And it is deeply ingrained in the American psyche. America has been formed and shaped by slave patrols, gunslingers, Pinkerton and Baldwin Felt's detectives, gangs of strikebreakers, hired gun thugs, company militias, and the American Legion, originally right-wing World War I veterans who attacked Union agitators, especially those belonging to the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. The influence on the country of the White Citizens Council, the White League, which carried out public military drills and functioned as the armed wing of the Democratic Party in the South, the Knights of the White Camellia and the Ku Klux Klan, which boasted more than 3 million members between 1915 and 1944, and took over the governance of some states, has been equally profound. More recently, heavily armed mercenary paramilitaries, violent Cuban exile groups, and armed militias such as the Oath Keepers and the anti-immigration extremist group Ranch Rescue have perpetuated America's seamless tradition of vigilantism. These vigilante groups have been tolerated and often encouraged and utilized by the ruling elite. And roaming the landscape along with these vigilante groups have been lone gunmen and mass killers who murder for money or power or to appease their own personal demons. Vigilante groups in America do not trade violence for violence. They are mostly white men who often prey on people of color and radicals. They are capitalism's ideological vanguard, its shock troops used to break populist movements and tyrannize the oppressed. And they will be unleashed against any mass movement that seriously threatens the structures of capitalist power and calls for rebellion. Imagine if, instead of right-wing militias, so-called eco-terrorists, who have never been found responsible for taking a single American life, had showed up armed in Nevada on April 12, 2014, to challenge the federal government's attempt to thwart rancher Cliven Bundy from continuing to graze his cattle on public land. How would the authorities have responded if those carrying guns had been from the environmental group Earth First? What if they had been black? The long struggle to abolish slavery, then to free blacks from the reign of terror after the Civil War, and to build labor unions and organize for workers' rights, these movements flushed from the bowels of American society the thugs who found a sense of self-worth and intoxicating power in their role as armed vigilantes. In America, such thugs have always worked for minimal pay and the license to use indiscriminate violence against those branded as anti-American. It was armed vigilantes who in 1914 attacked a tent encampment of workers in Ludlow, Colorado. The vigilantes set tents on fire, burning to death 11 children and 2 women. This brutality characterized the labor wars of the early 20th century. Vigilante groups working on behalf of coal, steel, and mining concerns gunned down hundreds of unarmed labor organizers. Thousands more were wounded. The United States had the most violent labor wars in the industrialized world, as the scholars Philip Taft and Philip Ross have documented. And murderous rampages by these vigilante groups, almost always in the pay of companies or oligarchs, were sanctioned even though no American labor union ever publicly called for an armed uprising. There is no American immigrant group, from Chinese laborers to the Irish, who have not suffered the wrath of armed vigilantes. And African Americans know too intimately how judicial systems work to protect white vigilantes and police who gun down unarmed black men, women, and children. There is a long tragic continuum from the murders and lynching of blacks following emancipation to the strangulation on July 17, 2014 of Eric Garner in Staten Island by police who charged him with selling loose, untaxed cigarettes, as well as the shooting to death on August 9, 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri of an unarmed African-American teenager, Michael Brown, by a white police officer. It is lynching by another name. The police officers who carried out these murders, offering a window into a court system that routinely ignores black suffering and murder, were never charged with a crime. And the longer this continues, the more likely become random and violent acts of retaliation, which the state will label terrorism and use to justify odious forms of repression. Once this eruption happens, as American history has illustrated, white vigilantes, along with the organs of state security, are given carte blanche to attack and even murder those who are demonized as enemies of the state. Vigilante thugs serve the interests of the power elites, as in the case involving the Nevada rancher, who made war, in essence, on behalf of corporations that seek to eradicate public ownership of land. These vigilantes revel in a demented hypermasculinity. They champion a racist nationalism and sexism, and they have huge megaphones on the airwaves funded by the most retrograde forces in American capitalism. The gang violence in poor urban neighborhoods in cities like Chicago or Detroit credentializes these vigilante groups and stokes the inchoate fear of blacks among whites that lies at the core of the gun culture and American vigilantism. The raison d'être given by vigilante groups for the need to bear arms is that guns protect us from tyranny. Guns keep us safe in our homes. Guns are the bulwark of liberty. But history does not support this contention. The Communist Party, during the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany, did not lack for weapons. Throughout the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, citizens had assault weapons in their homes. During the war in Yugoslavia, AK-47 assault rifles were almost as common in households as stoves. I watched in Iraq and Yugoslavia as heavily armed units encircled houses and those inside walked out with their hands in the air, leaving their assault rifles behind. American vigilantes will act no differently if members of the U.S. Army or SWAT teams surround their homes. When 10,000 armed coal miners at Blair Mountain in West Virginia rose up in 1921 for the right to form unions and held gun thugs and company militias at bay for 5 days, the government called in the Army. The miners were not suicidal. When the Army arrived, they disbanded. And faced with the full weight of the U.S. military, armed vigilante groups today will disband as well. The militias in Nevada might have gotten the Bureau of Land Management to back down, but they would have scattered like a flock of frightened crows if the government had sent in the 101st Airborne. The engine of vigilante violence is not fear of government. It is the fear by white people of the black underclass and of the radicals who champion the cause of the oppressed. The black underclass has been enslaved, lynched, imprisoned, and impoverished for centuries. The white vigilantes do not acknowledge the reality of this oppression, but at the same time they are deeply worried about retribution directed against whites. Guns for this reason are made easily available to white people, while gun ownership is largely criminalized for blacks. The hatred expressed by vigilante groups for people of color, along with Jews and Muslims, is matched by their hatred for the college-educated elite. The vigilantes see people of color, along with those who espouse the liberal social values of the college-educated elites, including gun control, as contaminants to society. Richard Rorty, in Achieving Our Country, Leftist Thought in 20th Century America, fears that a breakdown will be inevitable once workers realize that the government has no genuine interest in raising low and substandard wages, halting the exportation of jobs overseas, or curbing crippling personal debt. White-collar workers who are also being downsized will turn to the far right, he writes, and refuse to be taxed to provide social benefits. At that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking for a strongman to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodern professors will no longer be calling the shots. A scenario like that of Sinclair Lewis's novel, It Can't Happen Here, may then be played out. For once such a strong man takes office, nobody can predict what will happen. In 1932, most of the predictions made about what would happen if Hindenburg named Hitler chancellor were wildly over-optimistic. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. The words nigger and kike will once again be heard in the workplace. All the sadism which the academic left tried to make unacceptable to its students will come flooding back. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. America's episodic violence, while dwarfed by the campaigns of genocide and mass extermination carried out by totalitarian systems led by the Nazis, Joseph Stalin, and Mao Zedong, is nevertheless, as the black activist H. Rapp Brown once said, as American as cherry pie. We have always mythologized, even idolized, our vigilante killers, the Indian fighters, gunslingers, and outlaws on the frontier, as well as the mobsters and the feuding clans such as the Hatfields and McCoys, color our history. Vigilantes and lone avengers are the popular heroes in American culture. They are celebrated on television and in Hollywood movies. Audiences, especially as they feel economic and political power slipping from their hands, yearn for the violent authority embodied in rogue cops in films such as Dirty Harry, or in unrepentant killers such as Bradley Cooper in American Sniper. D.W. Griffith's 1915 film The Birth of a Nation, inspired by and adapted in part from Thomas Dixon Jr.'s novel The Klansman, was the prototype for the filmic celebrations of American vigilante violence. President Woodrow Wilson held a screening of The Birth of a Nation. It was the first motion picture shown at the White House. Wilson praised Griffith's portrayal of savage, animalistic black men, portrayed by white actors in blackface, humiliating noble Southern men and carrying out sexual assaults on white women. "It is like writing history with lightning, and my only regret is that it is all so terribly true," Wilson reportedly said. The film swept the nation. White audiences, including in the North, cheered the white vigilantes. The ranks of the Ku Klux Klan exploded by a few million following the film's release. The really rapid growth of the Klan did not occur in the early years when The Birth of a Nation was at the peak of its influence and availability. By 1919, the Klan had only a few thousand members. Not until the summer of 1920, 5 years after the film's release, did the real expansion of the Klan begin. By the summer of 1921, it had around 100,000 members. By the middle years of the 1920s, the Klan, according to Nancy McLean, may have reached a peak of 5 million members spread across the nation. It is impossible to say with any certainty what the precise role of The Birth of a Nation was in encouraging this increase. But as African-American scholar Lawrence Reddick noted in 1944, its glorification of the Ku Klux Klan was at least one factor which enabled the Klan to enter upon its period of greatest expansion. James Baldwin called the film an elaborate justification of mass murder. A century later, our culture's long infatuation with guns and acquiescence to vigilante killings continue to inspire the lone vigilantism of gunmen such as George Zimmerman, who followed an unarmed black teenager, Trayvon Martin, through a gated community in Florida and killed him. That state's Stand Your Ground law that allowed Zimmerman to be acquitted of murder is the judicial sanction of vigilante violence. In 1984, Bernard Goetz, in one of the most celebrated cases of vigilante violence, used an unlicensed gun to shoot 4 black teenagers in a New York subway car. He claimed the black men were trying to mug him. The National Rifle Association, NRA, was linked to Goetz's legal defense, and one of the NRA's daughter organizations, the Firearms Civil Rights Legal Defense, provided funds. Getz was acquitted of attempted murder and convicted only of illegal possession of a firearm, for which he spent 8 months in jail. The case strengthened arguments for less restrictive concealed carry laws. It was because of Getz and the NRA that Zimmerman was legally permitted to carry the concealed Kel-Tec PF9 pistol he used to murder an unarmed 17-year-old boy. In December 2012, 20 first graders and 6 adults were gunned down in an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, yet the Senate will not pass legislation imposing stiffer background checks on gun purchasers, nor a ban on assault weapons. On average, 32 Americans are murdered with guns every day. Another 140 are treated for a gun assault in an emergency room. Some 30,000 Americans die each year from gunfire, and about 2/3 of the shootings are suicides. But Newtown, like the mass shootings at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, 12 dead, at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, 33 dead, at the Immigration Center in Binghamton, New York, 14 dead, and at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, 15 dead, has had no discernible effect on mitigating our gun culture. There has been a school shooting on average every 10 days since the Newtown massacre. The state has never opposed the widespread public ownership of guns because these weapons have rarely been deployed against the state. In this, the United States is an anomaly. It has a heavily armed population and yet maintains remarkable political stability because, as Hofstadter writes in American Violence, our violence lacks both an ideological and geographical center. It lacks cohesion. It has been too various, diffuse, and spontaneous to be forged into a single, sustained, inveterate hatred shared by entire social classes. He adds that Americans also have a remarkable lack of memory where violence is concerned and have left most of our excesses a part of our buried history. Hofstadter notes that most of our violence has taken the form of action by one group of citizens against another group, rather than by citizens against the state. The sheer size of the country, the mixed ethnic, religious, and racial composition of the people, and the diffuseness of power under our federal system have all tended to blunt or minimize citizen versus state conflicts and to throw citizen versus citizen conflicts into high relief. We are not a people with a revolutionary or an insurrectionary tradition. The War of Independence, while it borrowed the rhetoric of revolution, replaced a foreign oligarchy with a native slaveholding oligarchy. The Founding Fathers were conservative. The primacy of private property, especially slaves, was paramount to the nation's founders. The framers of the Constitution established a series of mechanisms to thwart the popular will, from the Electoral College to the appointment of senators, buttressed by the disenfranchisement of African Americans, women, Native Americans, and the landless. George Washington, probably the wealthiest man in the country when the war was over, much of his money was earned by speculating on seized Indian land, shared exclusive economic and political power with his fellow aristocrats. This distrust of popular rule among the elite runs in a straight line from the Federalist Papers and the Constitutional Convention of 1787 to the 2000 presidential election, where the Democratic candidate, Al Gore, received over 500,000 more popular votes than the Republican, George W. Bush. The few armed rebellions, such as the 1786 and 1787 Shays Rebellion and the 1921 armed uprising at Blair Mountain, were swiftly and brutally put down by a combination of armed vigilante groups and government troops. More importantly, these rebellions were concerned with specific local grievances rather than broad political and ideological disputes. Since our violence did not typically begin with anyone's desire to subvert the state, it did not typically end by undermining the legitimacy of authority, Hofstadter writes. The federal structure, as Hofstadter notes, has effectively diverted violence away from symbols of national power to regional or state authority. The miners at Blair Mountain picked up weapons for the right to organize unions in West Virginia. African Americans, enraged by police violence in Oakland, Chicago, Philadelphia, and other cities in the 1960s, created groups such as the Black Panthers, primarily for self-defense, Although the party later evolved into a quasi-revolutionary movement, the universal radical ideologies and utopian visions that sparked revolutions in Russia and Germany after World War I are alien to our intellectual tradition. Most American violence, Hofstetter observes, has been initiated with a conservative bias. It has been unleashed against abolitionists, Catholics, radicals, workers and labor organizers, Negroes, Orientals, and other ethnic or racial or ideological minorities, and has been used ostensibly to protect the American, the Southern, the white Protestant, or simply the established middle-class way of life and morals. A high proportion of our violent actions has thus come from the top dogs or the middle dogs. Such has been the character of most mob and vigilante movements. This may help to explain why so little of it has been used against state authority, and why in turn it has been so easily and indulgently forgotten. Thomas Paine is America's single great revolutionary theorist. We have produced a slew of admirable anarchists: Alexander Berkman, Emma Goldman, Dorothea Day, and Noam Chomsky. And radical leaders have arisen out of oppressed groups: Sitting Bull, Frederick Douglass, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Fannie Lou Hamer, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Cornel West, and bell hooks. But we do not have a tradition of revolutionists. This makes Paine unique. Paine's brilliance as a writer, his essay Common Sense, is one of the finest pieces of rhetorical writing in the English language, was matched by his understanding of British imperial power. No revolutionist can challenge power if he or she does not grasp how power works. Of Paine's many contributions to the American Revolution, this understanding ranks as one of the most important. Many American leaders, including Benjamin Franklin, were hoping to work out an accommodation with the British crown to keep America a British colony, just as many now believe they can work through traditional mechanisms of power, including electoral politics and the judicial system, to reform corporate power. Paine, partly because he did not come to America from England until he was 37, understood that the British monarchy, not unlike our corporate state, had no interest in accommodation. It became Paine's job to explain to his American audience the reality of British power and what effective resistance to this power would entail. Paine knew that the British government, which wielded the global imperial power that America wields today, was blinded by its hubris and military prowess. It had lost the ability to listen, and as a result, had lost the ability to make rational choices, as the inhabitants of New York would discover when British warships and mercenary troops during the Revolution mercilessly bombarded and occupied the city. The British foolishly believed that their superior military force alone would decide the conflict, the same mistake the United States made in Iraq and Afghanistan and earlier in Vietnam. Paine created a new revolutionary political vocabulary. Common Sense, Rights of Man, and The Age of Reason were the most widely read political tracts of the 18th century. Common Sense went through 25 editions and reached hundreds of thousands of readers in 1776 alone. It was the first political essay in Enlightenment Europe to call for a separation between civil society and the state, terms that political philosophers as far back as Aristotle, Koinonia Politicae, and Cicero, Socetas Civilis, had considered interchangeable. Civil society, Paine argued in defiance, must always act as a counterweight against the state in a democracy. Power, he warned, even in a democracy, carries within it the seeds of tyranny. Paine, as George Orwell and James Baldwin did later, used his pen as a weapon. He detested the flowery and ornate writing of his age, epitomized by academics and philosophers such as Edmund Burke, whose turgid prose he called bastilles of the word. His lucid, crystallite writing was deeply feared by the monarchies in Europe, as well as the Jacobins in France, who imprisoned Paine and planned to execute him for denouncing the Reign of Terror. He fearlessly spoke undeniable truths, and he did so in a language that was accessible. He called his readers to act upon these truths. "My motive and object in all my political works, beginning with Common Sense, Paine remembered in 1806, have been to rescue man from tyranny and false systems and false principles of government and enable him to be free. Chronically short of money, Paine pressed his publishers to print cheap editions so the poor and working classes could afford them, and he famously donated the profits of Common Sense and his popular Crisis Essays to help fund the Revolutionary War effort. "Where liberty is, there is my country," Benjamin Franklin once said to Paine. "Where liberty is not, there is my country," Paine replied. For Paine, the role of a citizen extended beyond national borders. The fight of those living under any system of tyranny was his fight. "When it shall be said in any country in the world, 'My poor are happy, neither ignorance nor distress is to be found among them, my jails are empty of prisoners, my streets of beggars, the aged are not in want, the taxes are not oppressive, the rational world is my friend, because I am a friend of happiness,' when these things can be said," wrote Paine, "then may that country boast of its constitution and its government." One of the most important keys to radical social change, as historian J.G.A. Pocock points out, is a change in the nature of language itself, in the emergence of both new words and new meanings for old words. "Language," he wrote, "is both a product of history and possesses a history of its own." The call for revolution advanced by Paine, like those from writers such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, were issued in the new language of secular rationalism, rather than the older language of religion. But Paine, unlike Rousseau, wrote in the everyday language of working people. Grounding his writing in their common experiences, he was the first political writer to extend debate beyond university halls, government office buildings, and elite clubs and salons to the streets and the taverns. Paine knew liberty was intimately connected with language, and he knew that those who seek to monopolize power always use inaccessible and specialized jargon to exclude the average citizen. Paine broke these chains. Paine's clarity will have to be replicated today. We too will have to form a new language. We will have to articulate our reality through the ideas of socialism rather than capitalism in an age of diminishing resources, and we will have to do this in a form that is accessible. Foner cites Paine's ability to reach the general population as one of his most significant achievements. Paine was one of the creators of this secular language of revolution, a language in which timeless discontents, millennial aspirations, and popular traditions were expressed in a strikingly new vocabulary. The very slogans and rallying cries we associate with the revolutions of the late 18th century come from Paine's writings. "The rights of man," "the age of reason," "the age of revolution," and "the times that try men's souls." Paine helped to transform the meaning of the key words of political discourse. In Common Sense, he was among the first writers to use republic in a positive rather than derogatory sense. In The Rights of Man, he abandoned the old classical definition of democracy as a state where each citizen participated directly in government and created its far broader, far more favorable modern meaning. Even the word revolution was transformed in his writing, from a term derived from the motion of planets and implying a cyclical view of history to one signifying vast and irreversible social and political change. Paine also understood that despotic regimes, and here the corporate state serves as a contemporary example, make war on reason and rational thought. They circumscribe free speech and free assembly. They marginalize and silence critics. They seek to subjugate all institutions to despotism, or, in our case, corporate power. They use propaganda to rob people of the language to describe their daily reality and discredit those who seek radical change. The goal is to render a population politically alienated. Those who live under despotic regimes, Paine noted, are denied the ability to communicate and discuss in a national forum their most basic concerns and grievances. And this suppression, Paine understood, has consequences. "Let men communicate their thoughts with freedom," Paine's attorney Thomas Erskine said, quoting Paine in Paine's 1792 trial in Britain for seditious libel, "and their indignation fly off like a fire spread on the surface, like gunpowder scattered, they kindle, they communicate. But the explosion is neither loud nor dangerous. Keep them under restraint. It is subterranean fire whose agitation is unseen till it bursts into earthquake or volcano. Finally, Paine understood that war is always the preferred activity of despotic states, for, as he would write in The Rights of Man, war is essentially the art of conquering at home. Paine paid for his honesty. When he returned to England, where he wrote The Rights of Man, he was relentlessly persecuted by the state, as he would later be persecuted in France and in America upon his final return. John Keane, in his biography, Tom Paine, A Political Life, describes some of what Paine endured as a radical in late 18th century England. Government spies tailed him constantly on London streets, sending back a stream of reports to the Home Secretary's office. Those parts of the press that functioned as government mouthpieces pelted him with abuse. "It is earnestly recommended to Mad Tom," snarled the Times, "that he should embark for France and there be naturalized into the regular confusion of democracy." Broadsheets containing intercepted correspondence from Satan to Citizen Paine pictured him as a three-hearted, fire-breathing monster named Tom Stitch. Open letters, often identically worded but signed with different pen names, were circulated through taverns and alehouses. "Brother weavers and artificers," thundered a gentleman to the inhabitants of Manchester and Salford, "do not let us be humbugged by Mr. Paine, who tells us a great many truths in his book in order to shove off his lies." Dozens of sermons and satires directed at Paine were published, many of them written anonymously, for commoners by upper-class foes masquerading as commoners. Paine's power, like Orwell's and Baldwin's, lay in his refusal to be anyone's propagandist. He told people, even people who supported him, what they often did not want to hear. He may have embraced the American Revolution, as he embraced the French Revolution, but he was a fierce abolitionist and a foe of the use of terror as a political tool, a stance for which he was eventually imprisoned in revolutionary France. He asked the American revolutionaries with what consistency or decency they could complain so loudly of attempts to enslave them while they hold so many hundred thousands in slavery. He denounced in the National Convention in France, where he was one of two foreigners allowed to be elected and sit as a delegate, the calls in the chamber to execute the king, Louis XVI. "He that would make his own liberty secure must guard even his enemy from oppression," Paine said. "For if he violates this duty, he establishes a precedent that will reach to himself. Unchecked legislatures," he warned, "could be as despotic as unchecked monarchs." His warning was prophetic. On July 24, 1794, the revolutionary government ordered that Paine, held in the Luxembourg prison, be executed. The next morning, a turnkey, walking down the corridor that held cells, chalked the doors of those to be taken to the guillotine the next morning. The turnkey chalked the number 4 on the inside of Paine's cell door, which was left open during the day for ventilation. It was only when another turnkey later in the day closed the door to Paine's cell that Paine and his cellmates were inadvertently spared. That evening, the armed squad that came to collect the condemned passed by Paine's door, the number 4 now facing the inside of the cell. They dragged out screaming prisoners in nearby cells, but left behind Paine, who was suffering from a high fever, and the others waiting breathless in a cell. Paine's placidity and calm, even in the face of death, made him one of the most beloved prisoners in the Luxembourg. When Georges-Jacques Danton and his supporters were brought into the prison for execution, Paine called out to him. The other prisoners watched as the Luxembourg's most renowned prisoner and the giant of the revolution clasped hands. Danton told Paine, "That which you did for the happiness and liberty of your country, I tried in vain to do for mine." Danton, after a moment, added, "I have been less fortunate." A fellow prisoner described Paine's countenance, his cheerful philosophy under certain expectation of death, his sensibility of heart, his brilliant powers of conversation, and his sportive vein of wit rendered him a very general favorite with his companions of misfortune, who found a refuge from evil in the charms of society. He was the confidant of the unhappy, the counselor of the perplexed, and to his sympathizing friendship, many a devoted victim in the hour of death confided the last cares of humanity and the last wishes of tenderness. Paine hated the pomp and arrogance of power and privilege. He retained throughout his life a fierce loyalty to the working class in which he was raised. High-sounding names like My Lord, he wrote, served only to overawe the superstitious vulgar and make them admire in the great the vices they would honestly condemn in themselves. He ridiculed the divine right of kings and popes. The British monarchy, which traced itself back 7 centuries to William the Conqueror, had been founded, he wrote, by a French bastard landing with armed banditti and establishing himself King of England against the consent of the natives, and he detested the superstition and power of religious dogma, equating Christian belief with Greek mythology. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions, set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit, he wrote. Paine posited that the self-professed virtuous people would smash the windows of the actual Christian God if God ever lived on earth. With his unrelenting commitment to truth and justice and eternal rebelliousness, Paine would later be vilified by the leaders of the new American Republic, who had no interest in the egalitarian society he championed. Paine attacked former revolutionaries, such as George Washington in the United States and Maximilien de Robespierre in France, who abused power in the name of the people. He was driven out of England by the government of William Pitt, and then ousted, after nearly a year in prison, from revolutionary France as well. By that time, he was an old man, and even his former champions in well-orchestrated smear campaigns routinely denounced him for his religious and political radicalism. The popular press in America dismissed him as that lying, drunken, brutal infidel. But Paine never veered from the proposition that liberty means the liberty to speak the truth, even if that truth is unpopular. He did not seek anyone's adulation. And by the end of his life, like most rebels who have held fast to the vision that took hold of them, he was an outcast. He died, largely forgotten, in New York City in June 1809. 6 people went to his funeral. 2 of them were black. Any revolutionary movement that builds a mass following will have to contend with the kind of state-orchestrated vilification and vigilante violence that plagued Paine's life. Vitriol and violence will be unleashed, with a tacit approval of the state, on all who resist, even nonviolently. These reactionary movements, while defining themselves as the guardians of patriotism and the Christian faith, will draw on the deep reserves of racial hostility. The hidden agenda of right-wing militias, the Tea Party, the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, the National Rifle Association, and the survivalist cults is to ensure that guns will keep the home and family from being overrun by the crazed black hordes that will escape from their colonies in our urban slums. The mother of Adam Lanza, who carried out the Newtown massacre after first killing her, was a survivalist. She had stockpiled weapons in her home for impending social and economic collapse. Scratch the surface of the survivalist cult in the United States, and you expose terrified white supremacists. This inchoate terror of black violence in retribution for white vigilante violence and state-sanctioned violence is articulated in the Turner Diaries, a novel by William Luther Pierce that he published pseudonymously under the name Andrew MacDonald. The book inspired Timothy McVeigh to bomb the federal building in Oklahoma City, and it is given brilliant expression in Robert Crumb's savage exploration of white nightmares in his comic When the Niggers Take Over America. Again, I say that each and every Negro during the last 300 years possesses from that heritage a greater burden of hate for America than they themselves know. Richard Wright noted in his journal in 1945. Perhaps it is well that Negroes try to be as unintellectual as possible, for if they ever started really thinking about what happened to them, they'd go wild. And perhaps that is the secret of whites who want to believe that Negroes really have no memory. For if they thought that Negroes remembered, they would start out to shoot them all in sheer self-defense. The breakdown of American society will trigger a popular backlash, which we glimpsed in the Occupy movement, but it will also energize the traditional armed vigilante groups that embrace a version of American fascism that fuses Christian and national symbols. The longer we remain in a state of political paralysis, dominated by a corporate elite that refuses to respond to the growing misery and governed by an ineffectual liberal elite, the more the rage of the white male underclass, whose economic status often replicates that of poor blacks, will find expression through violence. If it remains true to the American tradition, this violence will not be directed at the power elite, but will single out minorities, dissidents, activists, radicals, and scapegoats. The language of violence also presages violence. I have watched this take place in the wars I covered as a foreign correspondent in Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. The impoverishment of a working class and the snuffing out of hope and opportunity always produce angry mobs ready to kill and be killed. A discredited liberal elite gets swept aside. Thugs and demagogues play to the passions of the crowd. I know each act of the drama. I have heard it in other tongues, in other lands. I recognize the stock characters, the same buffoons, charlatans, and fools, the same confused, enraged crowds, and the same impotent and despised liberal class that deserves the hatred it engenders. The unraveling of America mirrors the unraveling of Yugoslavia. The Balkan War was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. The petty criminals and goons who took power harnessed the rage and despair of the unemployed and the desperate. They singled out convenient scapegoats, from ethnic Croats to Muslims to Kosovar Albanians to gypsies, and armed their own vigilantes. They set up movements that unleashed a feeding frenzy leading to war and self-immolation. There is little difference between the ludicrous would-be poet Radovan Karadzic, who was a figure of ridicule in Sarajevo before the war, and the moronic Glenn Beck or Sarah Palin. There is little difference between the Oath Keepers and the Serbian militias. We can laugh at these people. They are often idiots and buffoons, but they are also dangerous. Gabriel Giffords, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, was shot in the head in January 2011 as she held a meeting in a supermarket parking lot in Arizona. 18 other people were wounded. 6 of them died. Sarah Palin's Political Action Committee had previously targeted Giffords and other Democrats with crosshairs on an electoral map. When someone like Palin posts a map with crosshairs saying, "Don't retreat, instead, reload," there are desperate, enraged people with weapons who act. When Christian fascists stand in the pulpits of megachurches and denounce Barack Obama as the Antichrist, there are messianic believers who believe it. When a Republican lawmaker shouts "baby killer" at Michigan Democrat Bart Stupak, there are violent extremists who see the mission of saving the unborn as a sacred duty. They have little left to lose. These movements are not yet full-blown fascist movements. They do not openly call for the extermination of ethnic or religious groups. They do not openly advocate violence. But as I was told by Fritz Stern, a scholar of fascism who has written about the origins of Nazism and who fled Nazi Germany as a young man, in Germany, there was a yearning for fascism before fascism was invented. It is the yearning that we now see. If we do not swiftly reincorporate the unemployed and the poor back into the economy, giving them jobs and relief from crippling debt, then the nascent racism and violence that are leaping up around the edges of American society will become a full-blown conflagration. Left unchecked, the hatred for radical Islam will transform itself into a hatred for Muslims. The hatred for undocumented workers will become a hatred for Mexicans and Central Americans. The hatred for those not defined by this largely white movement as American patriots will become a hatred for African Americans. The hatred for liberals will morph into a hatred for all democratic institutions, from universities to government agencies to the press. Beleaguered whites, battered by a stagnant and flagging economy, are retreating, especially in the South, into a mythical self-glorification built around the Confederacy. This retreat resembles the absurdist national and ethnic myths that characterized the former Yugoslavia when it unraveled. Serbian, Croatian, and Muslim ethnic groups, out of work and plagued by hyperinflation, built fantasies of a glorious past that became a substitute for history. The ethnic groups, worshipping their own mythic virtues and courage and wallowing in historical examples of their own victimhood, vomited up demagogues and murderers such as Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic. To restore this mythological past, they sought to remove, through exclusion and, finally, violence, competing ethnicities. The embrace of non-reality-based belief systems made communication among ethnic groups impossible. They no longer spoke the same cultural or historical language. They believed in their private fantasy. And because they believed in fantasy, they had no common historical narrative built around verifiable truth, and no way finally to communicate with anyone who did not share their self-delusion. Tennessee celebrates July 13 as Nathan Bedford Forrest Day, the birthday of the Confederate general and first leader of the KKK. There are 32 historical markers commemorating Forrest in Tennessee alone. There are 3 Confederate holidays in Alabama, including Robert E. Lee, Martin Luther King Day. Florida, Georgia, and Mississippi also officially acknowledge Lee's birthday. Jefferson Davis's birthday is recognized in Alabama, and reenactments of Confederate victories in the Civil War crowd Southern calendars. Although the South has long been enthralled to its Confederate history, there has been a surge of public commemoration of the Confederacy in recent years, as I would discover on a trip through the South in 2013. Those commemorations reminded me of the idealized historical narratives celebrated by competing ethnic groups that swept through Yugoslavia before the war. The desperate, then and now, whose identities and self-worth are lost in collapsing economies, fashion new identities out of myth. Flyers reading, "Loyal White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan wants you to join," appeared in residential mailboxes in Memphis when I was in that city on this trip. The Klan had also recently distributed pamphlets in a suburb of Atlanta. Later, in Montgomery, Alabama, I walked along the banks of the Alabama River, which were largely deserted, in the late afternoon with Brian Stevenson, an African-American lawyer who has spent his life fighting for prisoners on death row. He and I moved slowly up the cobblestones from the expanse of the river into the center of city. We passed through a small, gloomy tunnel beneath some railway tracks, climbed a slight incline, and stood at the head of Commerce Street, which runs into Court Square, the heart of Alabama's capital. The walk was one of the most notorious in the antebellum South. This street was the most active slave trading space in America for almost a decade, Stevenson said. 4 slave depots stood nearby. They would bring people off the boat. They would parade them up the street in chains. White plantation owners and local slave traders would get on the sidewalks. They'd watch them as they went up the street. Then they would follow behind up to the circle. And that is when they would have their slave auctions. Anybody they didn't sell that day, they would keep in these slave depots, he continued. We walked past a monument to the Confederate flag as we retraced the steps taken by tens of thousands of slaves who had been chained together in coffles of up to 100 or more men, women, and children, all herded by traders who carried guns and whips. Stevenson and I stood in Court Square, where the slaves had been sold. A bronze fountain with a statue of the Goddess of Liberty spewed jets of water in the plaza. Montgomery was notorious for not having rules that required slave traders to prove that the person had been formally enslaved, Stevenson explained. You could kidnap free black people, bring them to Montgomery, and sell them. They also did not have rules that restricted the purchasing of partial families. We fell silent. It was here, in this square, a square adorned with a historical marker celebrating the presence in Montgomery of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, that men and women fell to their knees, weeping and beseeching slaveholders not to separate them from their husbands, wives, and children. It was here that girls and boys screamed as their fathers and mothers were taken from them. This whole street is rich with this history, he said. But nobody wants to talk about this slavery stuff. Nobody. Stevenson said he wants to start a campaign to erect monuments to that history on the sites of lynchings, slave auctions, and slave depots. When we start talking about it, people will be outraged, he said. They will be provoked. They will be angry. The Confederate memorials, plaques, and monuments we passed, Stevenson said, have all appeared in the last couple of decades. A massive Confederate flag, placed by the Sons of Confederate Veterans, was displayed on the highway into the city. Whites in Montgomery, which is half black, had recently reenacted the inauguration of Confederate President Jefferson Davis by parading through the streets in Confederate uniforms, holding Confederate flags, and surrounding a carriage that carried a man dressed up as Davis. They held the ceremony of the inauguration on the steps of the state capitol. At the same time, Alabama sentences more people to death per capita than any other state. With no state-funded program to provide legal assistance to death row prisoners, half of the condemned are represented by court-appointed lawyers, whose compensation is capped at $1,000. Few of the condemned ever have an adequate defense. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, in a state with a population that is 27% black, nearly half of Alabama's death row is black, and 83% of the 757 people executed by Alabama since capital punishment began in the state have been black. Stevenson's career as a lawyer for death row prisoners began with a collect call from Herbert Richardson, a death row inmate at Holman State Prison. Richardson, a disturbed Vietnam combat veteran, had left an explosive device on the porch of an estranged girlfriend. It killed a young girl. His execution was to be held in 30 days. Stevenson, after a second phone call, filed for an emergency stay of execution, which the state rejected. He never really got representation until we jumped in, Stevenson said. Stevenson went to the prison on the day of the execution, which was scheduled for midnight. He found his client surrounded by a half dozen family members, including the woman who had married him the week before. Richardson repeatedly asked Stevenson to make sure his wife received the American flag he would be given as a veteran. Although it was time for the visit to end, Stevenson recalled, the visitation officer was clearly emotionally unprepared to make these people leave. When the officer insisted, Stevenson said, Richardson's wife grabbed her husband. His wife says, I'm not leaving. Other people don't know what to do. They are holding on to him. The officer left. But her superiors sent her back in. The officer has tears running down her face. She looks to me and says, please, please help me. Stevenson began to hum a hymn. The room went still. The family started singing the words. Stevenson went over to the wife and said, we're going to have to let him go. She did. He then walked with Richardson to the execution chamber. Brian, it has been so strange, the condemned man said. All day long, people have been saying to me, what can I do to help you? I got up this morning, what can I get you for breakfast? What can I get you for lunch? What can I get you for dinner? Can I get you some stamps to mail your last letters? Do you need the phone? Do you need water? Do you need coffee? How can we help you? More people have said what they can do to help me in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did before. You never got the help you needed, Stevenson told him. And he made Richardson a promise. I will try and keep as many people out of this situation as possible. Richardson had asked the guards to play the old rugged cross before he died. As he was strapped into the electric chair and hooded, the hymn began to blare out from a cassette player. Then the warden pulled the switch. Do you think we should rape people who rape? Stevenson asked as we stood in the square. We don't rape rapists. Because we think about the person who would have to commit the rape. Should we assault people who have committed assault? We can't imagine replicating a rape or an assault and holding on to our dignity, integrity, and civility. But because we think we have found a way to kill people that is civilized and decent, we are comfortable. Stevenson turns frequently to the Bible. He quoted to me from the Gospel of John, where Jesus says of the woman who committed adultery, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." He tells me an elderly black woman once called him a stone catcher. There is no such thing as being a Christian and not being a stone catcher, he said. But that is exhausting. You're not going to catch them all. And it hurts. If it doesn't make you sad to have to do that, then you don't understand what it means to be engaged in an act of faith. But if you have the right relationship to it, it is less of a burden, finally, than a blessing. It makes you feel stronger. The South, indeed, much of the country, is becoming increasingly inhospitable to stone catchers. On a windy afternoon, I took a taxi to a depressed section of North Memphis to visit an old clapboard house that was once owned by a German immigrant named Jacob Burkel. Oral history, and oral history is all anyone has in this case, since no written documents survive, holds that Burkel used his house as a stop on the Underground Railroad for escaped slaves in the decade before the Civil War. The house is now a small museum called Slave Haven. It has artifacts such as leg irons, iron collars, and broadsheets advertising the sale of men, women, and children. In the gray floor of the porch is a trap door that leads to a long crawl space and a jagged hole in a brick cellar wall where fugitives could have pushed themselves down into the basement. Escaped slaves were purportedly guided by Burkel at night down a tunnel or trench toward the nearby Mississippi River and turned over to sympathetic river traders who took them north to Cairo, Illinois, and on to freedom in Canada. Burkel and his descendants had good reason to avoid written records and to keep their activities secret. Memphis, on the eve of the Civil War, was one of the biggest slave markets in the South. After the war, the city was an epicenter for Ku Klux Klan terror that included lynching, the nighttime burning of black churches and schools, and the killing of black leaders and their white supporters, atrocities that continued into the 20th century. A vigilante gunman in Memphis assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. If word had gotten out that Burkel used his home to help slaves escape, the structure would almost certainly have been burned, and Burkel or his descendants, at the very least, driven out of the city. The story of Burkel's aid to slaves fleeing bondage became public knowledge only a couple of decades ago. The modest public profile of the Burkel House stands in stunning contrast with a monument I visited in the center of Memphis to native son Nathan Bedford Forrest. Forrest, who is buried in Forest Park under a statue of himself in his Confederate general's uniform and mounted on a horse, is one of the most odious figures in American history. A moody, barely literate, violent man, he was not averse to shooting his own troops if he deemed them to be cowards. He became one of the wealthiest men in the South before the war as a planter and slave trader. As a Confederate general, he was noted for moronic aphorisms such as, "War means fighting, and fighting means killing." Forrest was, even by the accounts of those who served under him, a butcher. But he was also a brilliant cavalry commander who could move large numbers of troops over long distances to mount disastrously effective surprise assaults on Union troops. The historian Shelby Foote said that the Civil War produced two geniuses, Forrest and Abraham Lincoln. Forrest's penchant for warfare, however, was accompanied by a penchant for killing. He ordered a massacre at Fort Pillow in Henning, Tennessee, of some 300 black Union troops, although they had surrendered and put down their weapons, as well as the women and children who had sheltered in the fort. Following the war, Forrest was the first leader, or Grand Wizard, of the Ku Klux Klan, and on the huge plantation he owned outside of Memphis, he took advantage of the new convict lease system, which would last 30 years, to use black convicts as laborers, slaves, in all but name. Forrest, like many other white racists of the antebellum South, is one of many Confederate leaders who is enjoying a huge renaissance. When the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the Shelby County Historical Commission in 2012 put up a 1,000-pound granite marker at the entrance to the park that read Forest Park, the city, saying the groups had not obtained a permit, removed it with a crane. The dispute over the park name that was then raging in the Memphis City Council exposed the deep divide in Memphis and throughout much of the South between those who laud the Confederacy and those who detest it, a split that runs like a wide fault down racial lines. Blacks, who have called for the park to be named after the crusading black journalist Ida B. Wells, whose newspaper was based in Memphis, have been rebuffed. Wells was one of the nation's most courageous and important journalists. She moved to Memphis as a young woman to live with her aunt. Her investigations revealed that lynching was fundamentally a mechanism to rid white businessmen of black competitors. When Thomas Moss of Memphis, a black man who ran the People's Grocery Company, was murdered with his partners by a mob of whites and his store was looted and destroyed, Wells was incensed. "This is what opened my eyes to what lynching really was," she wrote. She noted that the Southerner had never gotten over this resentment that the Negro was no longer his plaything, his servant, and his source of income, and said that whites were using charges of rape against black business owners to mask this resentment. "The lynching of Moss," she wrote, "was an excuse to get rid of Negroes who were acquiring wealth and property and thus keep the race terrorized and keep the nigger down." White mobs destroyed Wells's newspaper, Free Speech, which railed against white vigilante violence, the inadequate black schools, segregation, discrimination, and a corrupt legal system that denied justice to blacks. Wells was forced to flee the city, becoming, as she wrote, an exile from home for hinting at the truth. The split in Memphis between those who hold up authentic heroes, people who fought to protect, defend, and preserve life, such as Wells and Burkle, and those who memorialize slave traders and bigots, such as Forrest, characterizes the ethic of vigilante violence. Honoring figures like Forrest in Memphis while ignoring Wells is like erecting a statue to the Nazi death camp commander Amon Göth in the Czech Republic town of Svitavy, the birthplace of Oskar Schindler, who rescued 1,200 Jews. This capturing of the past by American vigilantes, now well underway, will have disastrous consequences, as it did in Yugoslavia. Intolerance that leads to violence is being bred with a steady rise of ethnic nationalism over the past decade and the replacing of history with fabricated stories of lost glory. Violence becomes, in this perverted belief system, a cleansing agent, a way to restore a lost world. There are ample historical accounts that disprove the myths espoused by the neo-Confederates, including books such as the volume Race, Slavery, and the Civil War, The Tough Stuff of American History and Memory, edited by James Oliver Horton and Amanda Kleintop, along with numerous original documents, including South Carolina's Declaration of the Immediate Causes which Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. In that document, issued 4 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the state cited the election of a new president, whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery, as justifying its secession. But facts hold little sway with those who insist that the Civil War was not about slavery, but about states' rights and the protection of traditional Christianity. These records are useless in puncturing the collective self-delusion, just as documentary evidence does nothing to blunt the self-delusion of Holocaust deniers. Those who retreat into fantasy cannot be engaged in rational discussion, for fantasy is all that is left of their tattered self-esteem. Attacks on their myths as untrue trigger not a discussion of facts and evidence, but a ferocious emotional backlash. Such challenges of the myth threaten what is left of hope. Achilles V. Clark, a sergeant with the 20th Tennessee Cavalry under Forrest during the 1864 massacre at Fort Pillow, wrote to his sister after the attack, "The slaughter was awful. Words cannot describe the scene. The poor, deluded Negroes would run up to our men, fall upon their knees, and with uplifted hands scream for mercy, but they were ordered to their feet and then shot down. I, with several others, tried to stop the butchery, and at one time had partially succeeded, but General Forrest ordered them shot down like dogs, and the carnage continued. Finally, our men became sick of blood, and the firing ceased." Clark was a Southern white soldier in the Confederate Army, but his eyewitness account cannot influence those desperately seeking meaning and worth in an invented past. People pay for what they do, and still more for what they have allowed themselves to become, James Baldwin wrote. The crucial thing here is that the sum of these individual abdications menaces life all over the world. For in the generality, as social and moral and political and sexual entities, white Americans are probably the sickest and certainly the most dangerous people of any color to be found in the world today. Observing these Americans, he was not struck by their wickedness, he said, for that wickedness was but the spirit and the history of America. What struck me was the unbelievable dimension of their sorrow. I felt as though I had wandered into hell.